Michel, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation et c'est un grand plaisir de parler ici et présenter le travail qu'on a effectué d'abord à Max Planck, on fait l'Institut d'optique quantique et après maintenant à EPFL. So the title of my talk will be, in essence, quantum coherent coupling of a mechanical oscillator to an optical cavity mode, but I'd like for the talk today present, in essence, the field of optical mechanics in a little bit more general terms and also revise some of the concept that Michel in his lecture represented. So before starting, I should say the work for me in the field of optical mechanics has been a real joy and real pleasure, and in particular because of the people that actually have worked with me over the years. And just want to mention that for the work today, actually Samuel de l'Église was really instrumental, who is now in essence a permanent research member in the group of Antoine Heidemann. And there's also Olivier Ancizet, who is now a senior ETH researcher with his own group in Grenoble, who also took part in many of the measurements and in the experiments. In particular, also for this work, Ewald Verhagen, Albert Schliesser. Ewald is now moving over to Amsterdam to start his own group at the FOM Institute. And they all have been really integral part in this work and real pleasure to work with. Now, I'd like to just start briefly by noting that mechanical oscillators are very old technology. And mechanical oscillators are used in devices where we might not even perceive, okay, that they exist. And one example, for instance, are if you have your cell phone, inside your cell phone, there are so-called F-bar resonators, so flexural resonators made from a piezoelectric. And that are used, in fact, to convert or filter microwave signals, in essence, in the phone on domain. So the function of filtering is done much more efficiently, in essence, using a mechanical oscillator than with equivalent discrete element of capacitance and resistors and inductors. Now, this is one example. Another example, of course, all of you know are quartz tuning fork, which you know, in essence are our in essence, favorite element of timekeeping when it comes to your watch. And again, these are just two examples of classical systems very well known that really are ubiquitous in our daily life. Now, of course, coming from Switzerland, I have to, of course, also mention another nanoscale application. And this is, in this case, shown here. This is an atomic force microscope. And an atomic force microscope, you use, for instance, a cantilever to probe nanoscale phenomena. And the cantilever here can be really thought of as an intermediary. You are interested, for instance, in essence, your sample and its properties and its potential, for instance. And by having here a cantilever and measuring, in essence, the change of the resonance frequency as the cantilever approaches the sample and reading this out optically, you can, for instance, deduce, in essence, the structure of your sample. And this is, of course, a very powerful technique. It's really ubiquitous for all the nanoscopic physics at present days. You can also take this method to its very extreme, okay? And this has been pioneered by Dan Rugard, IBM. And this is a really pioneering experiment where they've taken the same AFM cantilever, but now actually place a small magnetic tip, okay, on the surface. And this magnetic island now is interacting, for instance, with a single spin here in a solid state matrix. And despite these forces being very small, okay, you can actually measure the deflection this presence of the spin causes on this magnetic island, okay, and read it out optically. So in some sense, this system is precisely the optomechanical system that in this lecture has been discussed. You parametrically couple the optical field to a mechanical oscillator. And in this case here, you really use it as a transducer by basically coupling the mechanical oscillator itself to, in essence, a magnetic island, which can then be susceptible to, for instance, spins in the environment. Now, in all these applications, however, the mechanical oscillator is completely classical. And this is rightfully so, because the thermal energy, K Boltzmann T, so at room temperature, say 25 millielectron volts, is typically much, much larger, in essence, than the oscillator quantum spacing. Okay? And that means that you really are, at least when it comes to room temperature, always in a completely thermal state, which is highly excited. So one question that has interested me and also many other research groups in this field of optomechanics, and again, it's very much at the core of this lecture series, is how you can place, in essence, mechanical systems in the quantum regime. And there really are, in essence, two major challenges with this regime. One, of course, is this very large thermal occupancy at room temperature, and even at low temperatures. So for example, if you have a 1 MHz oscillator and would like to reach a temperature where KBT becomes equal to level spacing, your temperature, in essence, needs to be about 50 microkelvin. So these are very low temperatures, which are typically not accessible with conventional cryogenics. Now, again, you've seen that optomechanical coupling allows you to provide, in essence, a method to achieve such temperatures by not using brute force cryogenic cooling, but rather the cooling, in essence, by using a very cold photon bath. But even if you can place a mechanical oscillator at very low temperatures, there's another challenge that comes with it. You also would like, in essence, to probe, for instance, position. And this implies that you need to have a sensitivity that is on the order of the zero-point motion of a mechanical oscillator. And if you have a macroscopic object, okay, where the masses are large, okay, these dimensions become exceedingly small. So the challenge of entering the quantum region of mechanics is therefore associated both with the preparation of the oscillator in a very low entropy kind of state, and moreover also the readout, okay, an equivalent, in essence, coupling strength to an optical field. Now, of course, as one field, there has been tremendously successful at really achieving quantum control over systems, and that is the field of atomic physics. So in atomic physics, it is possible to take atoms, okay, cool them in optical traps or electromagnetic traps, cool them to the ground state, and this is due to the developments in atomic laser cooling, which started with the early work by Art Ashkin at Bell Labs, who demonstrated you can use, in essence, radiation pressure to trap particles, and together with Steve Chu, he went on to show optical molasses, that is the cooling of atomic motion, okay, via the effect that Hensch and Schaller had predicted in 1975, which is using a red detuned laser beam to slow down the motion, in essence, of atomic species. Now, the question now is, can you, in essence, use the same technique, okay, and also apply it, in essence, to nano micromechanical systems, okay? Now, let me make one small side remark here. The ground state cooling of ions is not just a very elegant and, of course, remarkable result from a fundamental physics perspective, but really also led to new applications. So, for instance, if you ask the question, what are the world's best atomic clocks right now? They actually are based on laser-cooled trapped ions that deployed quantum logic to read out the optical transition. So it really shows that ground state cooling of ions, in essence, for instance, has really led to new tools in metrology. Okay, and so the hope, of course, is that we can extend the toolbox now away just from ions, but also to mesoscopic systems such as nanomechanical oscillators. So there's a saying that in the for every invention made in the Western world, that at least one Russian who thought about it before. And the same is also, in some sense, true for atomic laser cooling. Okay, there's a paper that I've printed here for you, which was published in 1970, and it was published by Vladimir Braginsky. And this paper, in its English translation, reads, "The Investigation of Dissipative Ponderomotive Effects of Electromagnetic Radiation." So what Braginsky was interested here is, in essence, a dissipative phenomena. In this case, he meant a phenomena that can cool motion, okay, of using electromagnetic radiation. Okay, so in some sense, he was interested in the laser cooling, okay, not of atomic systems, but rather of mechanical oscillators. In fact, the system he was looking at was in essence, shown here. These are two mirrors, okay, and again, this is the canonical optomechanical system that has been treated in this class, in this course, and he was interested, in essence, in knowing the repercussions of the intra-cavity field on the mechanical oscillator's coordinate. And what he noticed is that there's an effect by which the radiation pressure can either drive, amplify mechanical motion, or cool it, okay? And again, you can simply, in essence, view this interaction arising from this parametric Hamiltonian, where you couple the optical frequency, okay, to the mechanical oscillator coordinate, and this coupling occurs via this coupling constant, big G, which is the G3 that was introduced earlier in the class here by Michel. Now, you can also be very rigorous and derive a perturbation theory approach of the interaction Hamiltonian. Again, it's also something Michel did here in great length. And it's a three-wave mixing Hamiltonian, which couples, in essence, the optical photon number n, in essence, to the mechanical oscillator coordinate. Okay. Now, what is Hamiltonian allows you to do is really two things. Okay. First of all, one phenomena, okay, that can be described and derived by this interaction is the cooling of of the mechanical mode via electromagnetic radiation. And I just want to give a slightly different or very simple perspective of this cooling, okay, which is a completely classical description, and it's certainly also a classical effect. If you model, in essence, the mirror as having a certain spring constant, a certain frequency, and if you assume for the moment that there's a certain photon delay time, tau, associated with the field in the cavity, then if you displace the mirror, it takes the radiation pressure some time, in essence, to equilibrate to a new equilibrium value given with a modified mirror position. So that means that the mechanical oscillator with its coordinate x, its damping 1 over tau, and its mechanical frequency omega m, is really coupled, in essence, to radiation pressure, okay, which depends on the position of the mirror, but in this retarded way. So in this, where tau here is its photon lifetime. And provided this photon lifetime is long compared to the mechanical oscillator period, in essence, the radiation pressure can become out of phase, okay, with the with, in essence, the motion of the mirror. And this leads, in essence, to a cooling rate or amplification rate, okay, that is precisely what Braginsky derived in the 70s in this paper that I was showing you. Now, I should mention, Braginsky didn't just call it amplification or cooling. He really called it a parametric instability because he was very worried that the amplification of mirror motion could render gravitational wave interferometers, which were the subject of his research, unstable. Okay? So he was not so interested, in fact, about the cooling, but also noted that there is such an effect. Now, you can also be more formal, and just let me mention one more time this interaction Hamiltonian, in essence, where you couple the mechanical oscillator coordinate to the photon number in the cavity, in essence, really serves you to allow, in essence, or serves you two purposes. And I'll explain experiments that really utilize both. The first one is very much in the sense of Braginsky's earlier treatments, is this interactional Hamiltonian, okay, allows you to do optical readout. So if you look at the evolution of the optical field in the absence of any dissipation channels for simplicity here, then in essence there is a free evolution at the optical cavity eigenfrequency. But now what you can see is that the coupling to the mechanical oscillator modulates, in essence, the cavity resonance frequency. So again, this is parametric coupling that allows you to do very efficient readout. Now at the same time, okay, and this is really important, you cannot read out an object without exerting a back action. So that's why this concept of back action is extremely fundamental and is linked really very much to the Hamiltonian description of the measurement process itself. So if you look at the radiation pressure back action, then in essence the mechanical oscillator will experience a force proportional in essence to eta gray, the photon number in the cavity, okay? And this back action has two repercussions, okay? One is that there's a limit on how accurate you can measure the displacement of a mechanical oscillator, and that is given in essence by the quantum fluctuations in the photon number in the cavity. And then there's a classical manifestation of back action, and that is a cooling and amplification. Okay? And this arises from the retardation of the intercavity photon number with respect to the mechanical oscillator position. And this is a classical effect that gives both rise to amplification and also cooling. Now, again, the context in which Braginsky was making these predictions was the context of gravitational wave detection. So he was interested in detecting gravitational wave and proposed, in essence, the present-day gravitational wave interferometers. This is here one example of the one in Hanford. And it shows, again, the two arms, which are 4 kilometers long, and they are, in essence, in the mirrors are inside vacuum tubing. And if you were to look inside the gravitation interferometer, what you would see is you would see that the mirrors are harmonically suspended. Okay, and the reason they're harmonically suspended, of course, is to introduce a very good seismic suppression. Okay, but this also implies that the mass, okay, is coupled, in essence, to the radiation pressure field via this optomechanical coupling. So you have pendulum modes which are susceptible to the radiation pressure inside the interferometer. So again, Braginsky made back in the 60s these predictions. The first one is, again, the standard quantum limit for position detection arising from the quantum nature of the radiation pressure field, but also predicted that you can amplify and cool mechanical motion. Now, I should say that these predictions of cooling and amplification, at least in the case of gravitational wave interferometers, are very difficult to observe. Okay, and part of the reason simply is that the radiation pressure force is very faint. The masses of these mirrors are typically kilogram, so this corresponding displacements are very, very weak. But more importantly, the photon lifetime in the cavity is normally not matched to the one of the mechanical oscillator period, so you would not necessarily be in a regime where this retardation becomes important. Now, I want to mention that you can also be, again, more formal, and we had already heard this already in the lecture. I just want to briefly just mention it again. This interaction of optical and mechanical degree of freedom is really quite interesting because the optical mode here is living at 190 terahertz or even higher, so really in the optical domain, whereas the mechanical mode really is something that can principally be very, very weak, very low frequency. And the coupling is parametric and can be enhanced, okay, by the mean field in the cavity. So taking, in essence, this three-wave mixing Hamiltonian and linearizing it around the steady state of the dry field, A bar, that we basically shine in with an external laser, you can, in essence, equivalently obtain Hamiltonian that, in essence, is a beam splitter Hamiltonian. That is, provided you are satisfying the so-called resolved Zeitbend regime, where the mechanical frequency is much larger than the escape rate of photons in the cavity, you end up with a Hamiltonian that basically couples the fluctuation. So in essence, it annihilates, for instance, annihilates a phonon, creates a fluctuation in the optical field, or for instance, it creates here, in essence, a phonon and destroys here, in essence, a pump photon. And so this effective Hamiltonian, what is important about it, in essence, is proportional to this G, okay, so the frequency pull parameter, times the zero pump motion of the oscillator. So these two, in essence, are uniquely determined by the geometry and the type of system you have, okay? But a parameter which you can control, at least dynamically, is the mean field in the cavity, the A bar, okay? So this allows you to switch on and off this interaction, and more importantly also, in essence, ensure that this interaction can, for instance, overwhelm all other rates in the problem. So this Hamiltonian really, therefore, corresponds to a state swapping from, say, the coherent state in the optics to the mechanics and vice versa, with an optically tunable coupling rate. Now, again, there's kind of two interesting regimes, okay, that this coupling can lead to, and I just want to briefly mention. The first is, provided that your optical photons decay much quicker, in essence, than the mechanical damping rate, okay, then, in fact, you can have an interaction whereby you swap the thermostate of the mechanics into the optical field. And now if the optical field decays very quickly, okay, it doesn't have a chance to be written back into the mechanics. Okay. And what this means is that this interaction will imply cooling. Okay. And the rate at which you can cool is simply the coherent coupling rate, in essence, squared divided by the cavity decay rate. Okay. Now, the fastest rate at which you can cool will be limited naturally by the escape rate of photons. So the fastest cooling rate is just limited by kappa, so the decay of the optical field into its environment. There's also a quantum theory of this cooling that we've worked out a couple of years ago, and is also mentioned this morning in a lecture. And the quantum theory implies that you can reach the quantum ground state of motion provided, or one important condition is that you are in the so-called resolved Zeitmann condition, where the mechanical oscillator frequency is much larger, in essence, than the cavity decay rate. And this suppresses, in essence, the motional heating processes. Now, there's also, again, this frequency landscape picture. So cooling, for instance, would proceed by having a laser on a lower sideband, and photons, in essence, can enter the cavity via two pathways, either via direct absorption via the cavity Lorentzian. So these would be states, or these would be transitions which are not motionally changing. The mechanical oscillator would nominally state. Then there's also a motional changing state. So these are so-called carrier, or not carrier transition, but Zeitmann transitions. And these Zeitmann transitions would imply that the occupancy of the oscillator is removed by one quanta for exactly every photon that enters a cavity via this Zeitmann transition. Okay. Okay, so this technique, in essence, is very analogous to resolved sideband cooling, in essence, for ions. But again, the kind of interesting aspect here is that what you have is not a James Cumming type of Hamiltonian, but rather a Hamiltonian where you couple the fluctuations in the optical field to the mechanical oscillator. And again, both systems are harmonic oscillators, so both are bosonic systems. Now, another interesting regime is when you increase the coupling strength, okay, between the optical field and the mechanical field even further, where you make this coupling, in essence, the dominant rate in your problem, okay? And this is a regime, in essence, where you can have a coherent interaction between the mechanical oscillator and the optical field, okay? Now, as mentioned, this coherent coupling rate, okay, will depend on the geometry of the system, but it can also be enhanced simply by enhancing the mean field, okay, in the cavity, okay? So you can optically control it. Now, this rate has to be contrasted, okay, with the relevant decoherence rate of the environments. Okay, and there's here, in essence, an important distinction to make. On the one hand, the environment you have is the optical field. Okay, the optical field has a desirable property that at room temperature, there are, in essence, zero thermal photons in the optical field. Okay, so the relevant decoherence rate, so the rate at which one quanta will be lost to the environment, is simply given by the energy relaxation rate, kappa, of the cavity. Now, this is quite different for the case of the mechanical oscillator. So the mechanical oscillator, okay, has an energy decay rate, gamma m, but it actually is coupled to an environment that can be at very elevated temperature. So in equilibrium, it will have a very high number of quanta, nm bar. So this implies that if you were in a ground state, for instance, and asked the question, how long does it take for the mechanical oscillator to heat up by one quanta, that number is given by the energy decay rate times the average number of quanta in the environment. Now, and this also explains why it's so difficult, in essence, to reach this coherent coupling regime for mechanical oscillators. Because even if you have an oscillator at room temperature that may have only a line width of 1 hertz, the number of quanta at room temperature can reach in the hundreds of millions. And you quickly, in essence, then end up with decoherence rates that dominate and overwhelm your coherent interaction omega c between the mechanical oscillator and the light field. So a very desirable regime to be in is having this hierarchy where omega c is larger than kappa and gamma. And again, I want to draw your attention. This gamma here is not the mechanical damping rate. It's really the thermal decoherence rate of the system. So damping rate multiplied by the average occupancy in the environment. Now, I'd like to now discuss, after this brief review of some of the fundamentals, one system which we are studying in my group and which is particularly suited to investigate this optomechanical phenomena. And these are optical microresonators. Now, I should mention that the structures we're using are not 5-Pirol resonators, but take a rather different form. And the form they take is shown here. This is a toroidal periphery made from glass. Its diameter here is typically a fraction of human hair, so about, say, 30 to hundreds of micron. And the diameter, or the cross-section, is typically 3 to 4 to 5 micron in size, so typically wavelength scale. Now, these devices are sitting here on a silicon chip, and they're made, in essence, using the techniques and tools that are also used to make semiconductor chips. So these are just standard nano and microfabrication techniques. Now, this structure has one property that's very peculiar, and that is it can have very high quality factors. So this structure was first demonstrated and first created in the group of Kari Vahala, where I was a PhD and also a postdoc at Caltech until 2005. And these structures exhibit so-called whisper and gallery modes, where the light field is confined by total internal reflection. And the quality factors in these resonators, because of this very smooth toroidal boundary, okay, can reach values of easily more than 100 million. Okay, so we have line width here that is typically about a megahertz, corresponding to a finesse that can reach values up to 10 to the 6. Now, another important aspect about these toroidal resonators is that they can be very efficiently interfaced. Okay, and the way this is done is shown here in the upper right. What you see here is an optical fiber, but not a normal optical fiber, but an optical fiber which is tapered, where you reduce the initial diameter of 125 micron, say for an SMF-28 fiber, down to 1 micron, where part of the field now becomes evanescent and can, in essence, via tunnel coupling, couple into the resonator and out. And what's kind of remarkable about this coupling junction here, this is almost ideal. So there's no excess losses that are induced by the coupling itself. You can achieve, in essence, a perfect input and output coupling without, in essence, scattering into free space. And this coupling is extremely important because we want to bias our experiments in a regime where we can, for instance, couple most of the photons that are in the cavity back out into the optical fiber. Now, these resonators, these toroidal resonators coupled to these optical fibers, they have a variety of applications. And they can be used, for instance, for cavity QED. You can couple atoms, for instance, to a near field. You can embed them in water, functionalize their surface, and make very sensitive devices, for instance, that measure the presence of molecules. You can thereby make, in essence, molecular sensors that use this dispersive interaction. You can also dope these devices with rare earth ions and make microlasers. And if you pump them very hard, it's actually possible via the kernon here to generate optical frequency combs. And so there's a whole variety of applications, and they all draw from this benefit of having very long photon lifetime in these microscale volumes. Now, one important observation that I was involved in just before leaving Caltech in 2005 is that these toroidal resonators also have a mechanical mode. And it seems to be almost trivial in hindsight, but it's a very important realization. Because all of you know, of course, that if you take a wine glass and place your finger around it, there is a wine glass tone. There's a radio breathing mode that exists in this wine glass. And the same mechanical mode also exists, in essence, in the microresonators. But importantly, okay, this mechanical mode is coupled to the optical mode via radiation pressure. And this can simply be seen from a very classical point of view by noting that the photons, okay, as they travel around the cavity, they change the direction, in essence, by 360 degrees. So you have a 2HBK momentum transfer per round trip of the photon is taking. So there's a momentum transfer, a continuous momentum transfer, from the light field, actually, to the cavity that occurs via radiation pressure. Now let's look at the typical scales of these devices. So as I mentioned, the cavity line width can be quite very small, so megahertz and even below is possible. The typical resonance frequency of the mechanical oscillator, they range here about 50 megahertz, so a very high frequency. And this means here that you are comfortably residing in this so-called resolved sideband regime. So you have a 50 megahertz oscillator, 1 megahertz line width, so it would be a sideband factor of about 50. Now the masses compared to gravitational wave interferometers are many orders of magnitude smaller. Typical effective masses are in essence on the range of 10 to minus 11 kilograms. So these are very light objects. Now, not surprisingly, radiation pressure forces can therefore become really important in the description, actually, of the mechanical oscillator. So in some sense, these optical microresonators, they're really a natural embodiment, okay, of this optomechanical coupling on the microscale. And again, optical and mechanical mode here are co-located in the same structure and thereby give you a strong coupling. Now, just to quantify it, the typical coupling strength we have, the G naught, is about 1 kilohertz. That's the coupling strength we have. It has to be contrasted to a line width of 1 megahertz. But the important part here, again, is that the G naught can be mean field enhanced by pumping, in essence, photons in the cavity and thereby make this rate larger than the cavity decay rate, for instance. Now, over recent years, there's been many different systems, and these optical microcavities, as mentioned, they provide here now a different form of implementing the optomechanical coupling, originally conceived in the case of gravitational wave detection, by really using or making use of nanomicrofabrication technique and making use of this principle of co-locating optical and mechanical mode inside the same structure. And so there's a variety of systems, in essence, that have really appeared over the last years. And I just want to show this slide. So these systems range from photonic crystals to the structures that Conrad Leonard has been talking about, to membranes dispersively coupled in cavities. And there's virtually a very little limit of how you can engineer and how you can realize this optomechanical coupling. And there's continuous progress, actually, to increase this coupling strength G0. And of course, one long-term goal of the field is to make this G0, in essence, really comparable to the kappa and omega m. It's quite difficult, but again, there are steps and progress being made in this direction. Now, this is not an example I just want to highlight because this is a collaboration I've engaged in with Isabelle Robert at the LPN here in the CNRS. And we have looked at a structure that is very well known in the field of photonics. These are so-called L3 photonic crystals. They have been studied for about 20 years. And what we've looked at is not the optical mode, again, which is very well studied, but we've looked and observed localized mechanical modes that are, in essence, also present in the structure, strongly coupled to the light field. And again, this shows you also that you can go into a planar architecture where it is even conceivable, as shown by the work of Oscar Painter, to make, in essence, phononic waveguides and really also route the phonons on the chip using the same kind of techniques that have been used for the case of photonic crystals. Now, let me briefly mention, in essence, one aspect of the optomechanical coupling, which is the ability to make very sensitive measurements of the position, okay? In this case, the Brownian motion of the mechanical oscillator. So what I've shown here is a tapered optical fiber coupled to our whispering gallium mode resonator. And what happens here is, at room temperature, the mechanical oscillator will undergo, in essence, Brownian motion. It has a very large number of thermal quanta, about 100,000. And what will happen now is that the light that gets coupled into the cavity is phase modulated, okay, via this optomechanical interaction. And to read out this phase modulation, what we do is, in essence, we use a homodyne scheme. So we excite the cavity on resonance, transduce small position fluctuations and phase fluctuations, and then use a phase reference to measure the mechanical oscillator position. And if you do this, then in essence, what you obtain in time domain is a trace like this, where you see, in essence, the Brownian motion. In this case, again, these are small amplitudes, about 50 femtometer. This is just a time domain trace. And if you Fourier transform this, you obtain this spectrum. So it shows you here the carrier frequency of about 60 megahertz of the mechanical oscillator. The width gives you a damping rate, gamma m. And importantly, the area, in essence, underneath these curves, this gives you something that's proportional to temperature. And this will become important later in the talk when we talk about, in essence, cooling the mechanical oscillator. Now, the reality is a little more complex. There's not just one mechanical mode, but many mechanical modes. So again, this is the radio breathing modes here at about 40 megahertz, but there's other flexural modes in the structure that are also appearing in this noise spectrum and that we can also understand very well. And if you look very carefully, there's a background noise at low frequency, and this background noise comes from thermorefractive noise. In fact, the cavity frequency itself is not stable. It will fluctuate due to the presence of thermodynamic fluctuations. Michael Gorodetsky in Moscow State University has derived a theory, actually, how these fluctuations in the temperature should be transduced to frequency fluctuations. And this describes the operational principle of our devices in an almost excellent way. Now, the modes themselves, as I described, take different forms, so even flexural modes or torsional modes coupled to the optical cavity. The one that's most interesting for us is really the mode that is the mode 14 here, the radial breathing mode, Because this mode, in essence, provides the strongest optomechanical coupling and provides the strongest phase modulation also in the spectrum. And so this is the mode we work with and we utilize for our experiments. Now, you can ask yourself, how efficient are you at making a measurement of mechanical position? And for this, in essence, very natural the question to ask is what the signal to background of your measurement is. So what is shown here is a toroidal resonator at room temperature. So it has about 100,000 quanta of thermal energy, okay, of thermal noise in the mechanics. And what we can look at is a signal to background in this measurement. And this measurement, the signal to background, exceeds, in essence, 2 n bar, where n bar is the number of phonons in the system. And what this means is that we have a sensitivity, okay, in measuring the mechanical motion, that at room temperature is already sufficient, in principle, to measure the zero-point motion of the oscillator. Because as you were to take the oscillator and reduce its energy by a factor of 2n, so by going, in essence, to the ground state, you would still retain a signal-to-noise of greater unity. And why do we have this very high sensitivity? It has two reasons. One is we have a very large coupling rate, G0, at least compared to, say, systems that are more macroscopic due to this co-localization of optical and mechanical mode. And secondarily, because we use in these measurements, in essence, quantum-limited laser. So we're limited, in essence, in these measurements by the shortness of the laser, and the thermorefractive noise is low enough, far enough away at these high frequencies to not become important in this measurement sensitivity. So again, this shows you that this optomechanical coupling gives you a very efficient readout. Just for completeness, I want to mention that the optomechanical interaction can also be artificially introduced with an external object. And this is something that we investigated a number of years ago with Jörg Kotthaus and Eva Weick. And we are interested in the question to ask, can we measure not just the mechanical oscillator's radiative breathing mode with a sensitivity, okay, or an imprecision that is at the standard quantum limit, but rather can we also achieve this for objects outside of the resonator? In this case, we're interested at thin silicon nitride nanostrings that also have exceptionally low dissipation. And these can be brought into the near field of the resonator, and also for such an experimental scenario, we realize an imprecision at the standard quantum limit. Okay. And of course, you can also now move to different oscillators. So for an example is that we have been looking at in the past with collaborators from Vienna is graphene, for instance. Graphene's motion has also raised quite a bit of interest, and the near field coupling technique that in essence also allows you to obtain interaction can be used here to very sensitively transduce the graphene's motion, okay, into, in essence, a phase modulation that can be read out optically. Now, I'd like to move now away from this original context that Baginski proposed of making measurements, okay, on an oscillator using this optomechanical interaction and move on to a phenomena that we have called, in essence, optomechanically induced transparency. And this optomechanically induced transparency draws its analogon from its equivalent in the atomic domain. And let me just briefly mention, in the atomic domain, EIT is a phenomena which occurs that if you have two, in essence, ground states, okay, which have a dipole-forbidden transition, that are coupled to a joint excited state. And EIT is a phenomena by which a strong dressing laser on this transition that's marked 2 and 1 here, in essence, induces, in essence, a splitting of the excited state 3, and thereby actually causes an initially absorptive transition to become transparent. So if you probe with this green laser, for instance, transition 1-3, in the absence of the coupling laser, you would see absorption, whereas if you render laser 2-1 coupled to the excited state, in that moment you will create a transparency window. And you can think about this effect as really arising simply from interference, okay, of the electronic wave packets in the excited state here. Now you can do something quite similar in the optomechanical domain, and this we have termed optomechanically induced transparency. And this effect, we probe, in essence, the interaction of the optomechanical system in the following way. But first of all, we place a strong coupling field, A bar, on the lower sideband that gives us this equivalent, in essence, optomechanical interaction. And then, in addition, we introduce a small probe field, okay, that's shown in red here, and we use this to probe the cavity response, okay? Now, if you look, in essence, through its phenomena and you treat it mathematically, there's one aspect that is quite interesting, that the coupled equations of motion, in essence, for the optical field and for the mechanical oscillator, in the presence of these two tones, this strong coupling tone and this weak probe tone, they take exactly formally the same form as the equations for EIT, okay, where you treat the atomic polarizability and the optical field. Now, therefore, you also obtain here a very similar scenario whereby the red probe field, when it's scanned over the cavity resonance, does not only see the cavitation, okay, which is shown here in this graph, but also on resonance there's a very small dip, okay, and this dip arises, okay, from an interference effect, and this is now not an electronic interference as in the case of EIT, but an interference in the electromagnetic domain. So what happens is that as in essence the probe field is in essence probing the cavity, it is in essence beating, okay, with a coherent drive field that is very strong. This in turn gives a radiation pressure force that drives the mechanical oscillator, and it can drive it very effectively if the difference frequency between, in essence, the strong coupling field and the probe laser is exactly commensurate with the mechanical oscillator frequency. So that means that right on resonance, the mechanical oscillator is coherently excited by these two fields, and this will cause now photons to be scattered from the control field, okay, into the cavity, okay, with this frequency generate probe. And this implies now that there's a destructive interference actually in the intercavity field that actually allows you to render this transition suddenly transparent. Okay? So again, it's a very similar phenomenon as an atomic EIT, simply now transposed in the electromagnetic domain. Now, one really key feature of EIT, okay, is not just the transparency window, but the ability actually to actually turn on and off this transparency window with the control field. And that feature is also embodied in this experiment. So if you vary the power that is contained here in this control field, and you look at the depth, okay, of the transmission feature, what you see is that as you increase the power, okay, the transmission window gets deeper and wider. Okay? So you have an electromagnetically controlled, in essence, transparency window. Now, the width of this transparency window is simply given, in essence, by the in the weak coupling limit by the cooling rate, which is the coherent coupling rate, omega c squared, divided by kappa, the cavity line width. Okay? And as you see, as you increase, for instance, here, the power, this will become, in essence, equivalently larger in width. Now, the transmission window can also be written in a slightly different form. So the transmission on resonance is given by the cooperativity parameter C. And so the change in transmission by 50% would equivalently be linked to cooperativity of unity. And again, the cooperativity parameter is simply the coherent coupling rate divided by kappa and gamma m. And this shows you something interesting here. If you have a system with very low, in essence, dissipation, gamma m, and low optical line width, you can make this cooperativity parameter unity for a very low number of photons. Okay? Now, if you look in literature for different optomechanical systems and have been embodied, okay, then what you will see is for this work in the toroids, we need about 20,000 photons in the cavity to reach a cooperativity parameter of unity, so change in the transmission, in essence, by to 50%. Now, if you go to nanoscale systems, okay, for instance, these near-field coupled beams or photonic crystals, you can greatly, in essence, reduce that number. And there are even systems in photonic crystals, for instance, that can really reduce this number to just as little as 10 photons. So it really implies that this interaction of light and mechanics can be extremely nonlinear, even at the very low photon levels. Now, another application that results from this optomechanically induced transparency draws from the fact that if you look at a transmission window, as I described, you have the cavity Lorentzian with a very sharp feature in the middle that arises from this destructive interference. But then if you also turn yourself now to the frequency, to the phase domain, then right where there is a change in the probe transmission, there's also a very rapid variation of the phase. Okay? That implies what you can do here is you can slow down, in essence, optical pulses. Okay? So if you inject a pulse whose bandwidth is small, okay, compared to a transparency window, you can achieve, in essence, a delay of the pulse. And this delay will simply be proportional, okay, to the inverse of the damping rate, okay, and then weighted here with this cooperativity parameter. And for optimum choice of cooperativity, it implies that you can approximately delay the pulse, in essence, by twice the inverse damping rate. Since the inverse damping rate can be made very long, in essence, you can achieve here delays easily of milliseconds or seconds even for optical fields or for microwave fields. So it's a very useful, in essence, tool in that sense to slow down optical fields with transitions that are much narrower than those that can be found typically in atomic systems. Now, for a single optomechanical element, you can delay a pulse, but there's one aspect you will not achieve, and that is storing. Okay? You can only delay the pulse, in essence, by its temporal duration, but not for long amounts of time. In order to delay a pulse by a multiple of its pulse duration, what you need to do is you need to cascade optomechanical systems. And as I mentioned, in the case of photonic crystals, for instance, you can lay out, in essence, circuits on a chip that, in essence, cascade optical and mechanical mode, and thereby achieve, for instance, a mapping of an optical pulse into a long-lived mechanical excitation, in fact, into a superposition of different vibrational amplitudes. And by suitable control pulse, you can also read this out again and transfer it back to the optical domain. So one of the present outstanding goals in optical mechanics is to achieve, in essence, this conversion of an optical pulse, for instance, into a mechanical oscillator and back, using this architecture of this optomechanical coupling. And again, the technique that allows you to do this is a technique of this optomechanical transparency, this mapping, in essence, from optical to photonic domain. So in the last part of my presentation, I'd like to now really address the question, okay, can you take, in essence, these optomechanical systems, and can you reach a quantum regime with these systems? Okay, and this has been, in essence, a goal that with my research group back in Munich in 2006, we set out to do, and we have come great strides, and I'd like to tell you, in essence, the techniques that we have used to actually reach this goal. So as I mentioned, what we're using are our toroidal resonators. These are, so to speak, the platform. We know we have all the tools to read out the mechanical motion, okay, with very high sensitivity using, in essence, harmonic detection. And we also have this tool of optomechanical induced transparency to probe the interaction that the, a strong control field is causing between the optical and mechanical view of freedom. Now, to reach, in essence, a quantum coherent coupling regime, which I introduced in the beginning of the lecture, what we're really interested in doing is making this coherent coupling rate, omega c, between light and mechanics, make this larger than the cavity decay rate, but more importantly, for us, also larger than the thermal decoherence rate, so the energy damping times the mean number of quanta in the environment. And if you look at this, you can also re-express this mean number of quanta in the environment times the damping rate just by kBT over h bar q. So it shows that low temperature helps you to reduce that thermal decoherence rate, and also high mechanical quality factor also helps you to make, in essence, decoherence rate low. Now, the route we choose, in essence, to reach this coherent coupling regime is basically twofold. The first is we would like to naturally work in an as cold environment as possible, okay? And for the optical experiment, okay, this implies that a very natural and good choice is to work in a cold helium-free buffer gas cryostat. And this allows you to pre-cool the samples to about 600 millikelvin. So thereby, we can really reduce the thermal decoherence rate. The other aspect that we have at hand and at our disposition is really the kind of the strength and power of nano-microfabrication. So what we are doing is we like to artificially make the G-naught, okay, as large as possible, okay? And one way to do this is using cavities that have spoke-type supports, okay? So what we do here is we introduce in our toroidal resonator small spokes that in essence have a twofold purpose, okay? The first purpose is that they are chosen with the lengths to make actually the vibrations of the interior region of silica here to make this almost vanish, to almost go to zero. That is, we introduce, in essence, an effective barrier by which phonon tunneling losses into substrate, in essence, are almost negligible, okay? Now, the other aspect why these spokes actually are used is to make the structure more compliant, okay? We like to actually make, in essence, a zero-point motion of the oscillator as large as possible. And that means we, as we shrink the cavity structure, we want to actually avoid and oppose, okay, the rise in frequency. So by introducing these bridges here, we can make the mechanical oscillator frequency actually rather low, thereby have a larger zero-point motion, and thereby also effectively increase the G-naught. So it's really a twofold purpose here of these spokes. I'd like to mention that the design of these structures is not completely trivial. But there's very beautiful techniques to actually simulate the structures using COMSOL. It's a fine element solver, which you can both, in essence, simulate the phonon tunneling losses and also the mechanical eigenfrequencies, and really, in essence, pick spots where we have both high mechanical Q and high vacuum coupling rate. Now, of course, it's very nice to simulate these structures, but it's more important is to be able to fabricate it, and we can actually do this. So this is a structure here that is fabricated at EPFL in our cleanroom facility, and the so-called CMI. It has very small bridges. The bridge's diameter here is less than a micron, so these are made by dry etching. And again, we are able to retain, despite having these bridges here, the very high optical quality factor of the cavity. So we typically have a line width of 1 to 5 megahertz, so Qs that reach values of about up to 100 million. So the G-naught here, in essence, can be increased to about 3.5 kilohertz, and it is very, in essence, important for type of experiments of the coherent coupling I'll describe. Now, having these spoke-type resonators, we can now move to our cryogenic environment. And our cryogenic environment, in this case, is given by this cold helium-3 background gas. And this is an image here of the optical cryohead. So what you see here is a piece of glass that's about maybe 2 centimeters in height. And there's an optical fiber that you cannot see. This is a vertically mounted tapered optical fiber with a diameter of about less than a micron.
And this is actually coupled here with these toroidal resonators, which are on a very small chip, about 20 millimeters in length, sitting on atto cubes. And the entire device here actually mounts into a 6 centimeter bore that goes down into a helium-3 buffer gas cooling cryostat. Now, the buffer gas has one very desirable property. It is able to thermalize our mechanical resonator. And you can see that this is a challenge using other techniques because the cavity itself is suspended on this very thin silicon pillar. Okay? So attaching the sample to a cold finger would never allow you to thermalize the structure. So by having, in essence, a cold helium-3 buffer gas, in essence, you're able now to very effectively cool down the structure. And this is shown in the graph here. What's shown here is the temperature of the buffer gas, which we can vary. So we start here by 10 Kelvin, go down to 1 Kelvin. What we do is we measure the Brownian motion of the mechanical oscillator, and again, by virtue of this area theorem, deduce the effective temperature of the mechanical mode, and we can see that to the lowest temperature of our cryostat, in essence, the sample follows, okay, in essence, the temperature of the buffer gas. So we thermalize, in essence, faithfully to the lowest temperature of our cryostat. Now, nevertheless, even at the lowest temperatures, we still have typically more than 170 quanta of mechanical excitation in the system. So even these temperatures of 600 millikelvin are not sufficient, in essence, to reach a quantum regime of the mechanical oscillator. Okay, for this, you need to have this additional virtue of laser cooling. Now, at these low temperatures, there's also some quite interesting physics that you can study, and Olivier Altizé, my group, has studied this when we were back in Munich. This physics is related, in essence, to the physics of two-level systems. Because what we have in our cavity is an amorphous structure, okay, an amorphous cavity made from glass. So you can think of glass as a distorted version of crystalline quartz. And so it implies that the SiO2 molecules, actually, instead of being perfectly periodic, occasionally, in fact, form these networks where the SiO2 molecules is, in essence, free to vibrate, okay, and to take different conformal states, okay, in its amorphous surrounding. Now, this subject, actually, of the thermodynamic properties of amorphous solid is actually a very old subject, and it turns out that Anderson, Phillips, and Varma, in essence, looked at this back in the 70s to describe the anomalous behavior of the heat capacity at low temperatures in amorphous solids. And what they realized is that SiO2 molecule can really hop between two sides, which actually are energetically, in essence, separate only by a very small amount here, delta, and by a large barrier, in essence, that can be modulated by the incoming strain of the phonon. So that means actually that what happens here is that the phonon actually is coupled intrinsically, in essence, to, in essence, the two-level systems in the structure. And this actually is our dominant loss mechanism. Our dominant loss mechanism is actually coupling of the phonon to the TLS, the two-level systems of the glass. Now, I should mention that an individual two-level system, in the case of our large microscale cavities, has a coupling rate that is quite weak. Okay, so typically the coupling rate will be typically an order of kilohertz. Okay, but if you go to very small structures, actually, you can make this coupling rate also equivalently larger. Now, how does it manifest itself, this coupling to a TLS? It manifests itself by a known and describable temperature dependence of the damping. So we start out at 10 Kelvin, we have a so-called tunnel plateau. It's almost universal, in essence, for all amorphous materials. So independent of what amorphous material you use, the damping will typically give you quality factors of a few thousand at 10 Kelvin. And once you, in essence, reduce the temperature below typically a few Kelvin, you see here this very quick recovery of the mechanical quality factor. Okay, and we typically, at the lowest temperatures here, have a line width of 3 kilohertz or a QF product of 10 to the 12. Now, this is not the highest QF product. The highest right now, I think, is about 10 to the 16 by the work of Michael Tobar. But nevertheless, it shows you get long coherence times for these mechanical systems at low temperatures. So we have to work here at these temperatures of 0.6 Kelvin to benefit from this higher mechanical Q. We could not work here at elevated temperatures. Now, I should mention, of course, also that this very rapid dependence of the damping on temperature also renders this experiment very sensitive to excess heating. So we really have to avoid, in essence, to heat up our samples by the laser that we induce in our cryostat. Now, just a small image here of the experiment. So what you see here is the helium-3 buffer cryostat. We have preparation optics, readout optics. And now to cool the mechanical oscillator, the choice that we do in our experiments is in essence a titanium sapphire laser. So this is a very complex laser system. And this added complexity really comes with a reason. Okay? So in our earlier work in Munich, one of the lasers that we used in essence for laser cooling and for this coupling of light and mechanics were diode lasers. But diode lasers have one unfortunate, in essence, property, they have a relaxation oscillation frequency, which every laser has, but its relaxation oscillation frequency can take very elevated values. Okay, and this comes from the very fast carrier dynamics, okay, of the electrons in a semiconductor. And so this relaxation oscillation frequency, as for instance measured here by Wieman and Agila, I guess 20 years ago, can really reach values, in essence, of a couple of gigahertz. And this would imply that for the Fourier frequencies of interest for our work, we would not be able to work with a quantum-limited laser. So what we do in our case is we move to a titanium sapphire laser system, whereby you can really reduce this relaxation oscillation frequencies all the way from gigahertz all the way down to, in essence, below megahertz, and thereby effectively creating a region where your phase noise, in essence, becomes quantum-limited. Now, even if you have a titanium sapphire laser that is quantum-limited in amplitude and phase, okay, you still have to actually be very careful in these experiments. And this is one aspect we have seen. This is actually a harmonic detection signal with light running into the cryoset and out and interfering with our local oscillator beam. And what you can clearly see here is a structure to the noise. And this immediately tells you, okay, that you cannot be quantum-limited, at least not in this spectra, because there's a structure to the noise. And you would expect, in essence, a white noise for a quantum-limited process. What is happening here is the following, that even if you have a quantum-limited laser, if you propagate it through an optical fiber, a fiber has acoustic modes. And this was first discovered by Levinson and Shelby back in the 80s when they're working on squeezing in optical fibers using the Carnot linearity. And now what is the proof for this? Again, this is a harmonic detection signal. You see these peaks here. The moment you take, in essence, the buffer off, these peaks suddenly become very sharp. So it's just like taking your finger off the wine glass and suddenly allow it to have a higher mechanical quality factor. Now, what we do in our experiments here is we really suffer from, for instance, these very localized modes that are precisely coinciding with our mechanical oscillator frequency. But we can actually etch these optical fibers to a desired, in essence, size, and thereby move these so-called guide acoustic wave peaks out of the way of our mechanical oscillator, thereby effectively creating a window, in essence, where we, profit from the quantum-limited nature of our laser. So it really shows that you have to be very careful both at the phase noise side of the laser itself, but also actually in the phase noise side that is picked out by optical fibers themselves. Now, with these precautions reducing the phase noise due to guide acoustic waves, and also using a very quiet laser system, we are now in a position to venture in this quantum coherent coupling regime. And for this, again, we use our titanium sapphire laser. We pass, in essence, a portion of the beam into our cryostat, and we have a second part that serves as our local oscillator, and we do harmonic detection on the output. Now, the first thing we can do is, again, this coherence spectroscopy, by which we scan, in essence, a small probe field over the cavity resonance to determine, okay, the influence of the strong coupling laser onto the mechanical oscillator dynamics. What we see here is a typical homodyne spectra where you see the cavity Lorentzian, okay, and you see this very sharp dip here, which is, as I mentioned earlier, this transparency feature originating from optomechanically induced transparency. And the width of this feature here gives us, in essence, all the parameters that characterize the interaction, that is the coherent coupling rate, the detuning, and also the cavity decay rate. So this is, in essence, a spectroscopy technique by which we can determine the strength of interaction. Now, what we can do next is we do the same experiment by looking now at the fluctuational spectra of the mechanical oscillator. And we first place a laser very far from a lower sideband, where we have about 200 quanta in the oscillator. Now, if we move the laser, okay, closer to a lower sideband, so from blue to green to red, what we see is that we progressively, in essence, damp the oscillator, so we make its width wider, but importantly, also the area actually decreases. So this shows actually that you are cooling the mechanical oscillator. So again, all we have done in this experiment is kept the laser power constant and simply vary the detuning, okay? And from the lowest, in essence, or from the noise spectrum, and from the calibration using calibration peak, we can infer that the residual motion corresponds to, in essence, about 1.7 quanta. So this implies that the mechanical oscillator here, the toroidal radiant breathing mode, as it resides in the ground state more than a third of the time, okay? So we're really able to prepare these very low entropy states for mechanical oscillators. Now, if you look at this cooling spectra, one can already see that one is at the onset of strong coupling, because the coherent coupling rate, omega C, starts to really be larger than the thermal decoherence rate from the environment, okay? And this can also be seen in the reconstruction of the mechanical spectra. So this shows the laser detuning. We start out at about 150 quanta. We cool down to 1.7. But if you fit, in essence, the spectra, you see already a slight deviation from the expected, in essence, Lorentzian due to the onset of the coherent coupling regime. Okay. Now we can also understand this because the cavity line width of the optical mode in essence, is in the order of 2 megahertz. So we are approaching with our, in essence, coupling rates, the Kavi decay rate, and thereby start to be limited by the ability of the photon field to actually emit quanta in the environment, and thereby cool the mechanical oscillator. So also spoken differently, part of the excitations which you map from the mechanics to the optics actually get mapped back into the mechanical oscillator. Now we can also utilize this phenomena and probe it. By increasing the power even further, we can make this coherent coupling rate even larger, in essence, than the Kavi decay rate and the mechanical decoherence rate. Okay, and this shows here both an optical spectrum and a mechanical incoherent spectrum taken here in 2 succeeding steps. And what you can see here is that the optical cavity, in essence, as is probed by a second coherent probe tone, in essence, splits in two. So you see here, this is the cavity decay rate kappa, and the coupling rate here greatly exceeds already the decay rate. So we're able to arrive at precisely what Michel already mentioned this morning, this hybridization of optical and mechanical mode. Now you can also, in essence, analyze this in the mechanical oscillator domain. So this is, whereas the optical one is a coherent probing, we look here in the mechanical domain simply at the output spectrum of the phase fluctuations, okay, in the presence of only the coupling laser. And what you see here is that the mechanical excitations, in essence, are shared or coupled both to the optical and, or also coupled to the optical field, and the coupling rate given here by the splitting of this polariton branch. So we see here that we are in a regime where the mechanical oscillator, in essence, and the optical optical system are coupled, and they form this kind of joint system, which shares the thermal excitation that is residual in the system by the mechanical oscillator. Now, what you cannot tell from the spectra alone, okay, is if the coupling rate also exceeds the thermal decoherence rate. Okay, we know that the optical field and the mechanical oscillator, in essence, are exchanging energy that is faster than the optical decay rate. But to also determine if you're faster than the thermal decoherence rate, you really have to quantify, in essence, the residual amount of thermal decoherence. And the way you can do this in our experiments is, again, looking at our noise spectra, and the only free parameter to fit here is the vertical axis, which is the thermal decoherence rate. And if you look at the thermal decoherence rate, what we see is, as we scan the laser detuning from far away from the lower sideband, precisely to lower sideband, we can see two things. First of all, the cavity decay rate stays constant. This is expected, and this is a cavity which is completely linear. So as you fill the cavity with photons, the cavity decay rate does not change. Okay? Now what we also see is that as we increase, in essence, shown in red here, the laser power in the cavity, we increase the coherent coupling rate. Okay? But we also can see that we slightly increase the thermal decoherence rate. Okay? And they both actually follow the same dependence. And this is kind of expected, because as we actually are moving the probe tone closer to the cavity resonance, we are heating the cavity. Okay? So we're following here the Lorentzian profile of absorption. Okay, and precisely at the intercept here, at the lower sideband, we can actually satisfy, albeit only very narrowly, the condition where the coherent coupling rate, omega c, in essence, is larger than the thermal decoherence rate and also the Kavi decay rate kappa. And so this is precisely the regime now where you can start thinking about taking an optical quanta, mapping it to the mechanics and back, and doing this in a way of where it's quantum coherent. Of course, it suffices to say that what you, of course, want to realize is not just omega c larger, but omega c very much larger. So that's, of course, the regime where you can do a lot of the dynamical protocols that have also been discussed in earlier lectures here. Now, I should mention that the regime of this coherent coupling has so far only been achieved with using microwave systems in the experiments from the group of Cleland and UC Santa Barbara, and also Linard, who already discussed here the results a couple of weeks ago. And so with our toroidal systems now, we're able to access this regime now in the optical domain. Okay, and this has interesting repercussions, because now we can map, for instance, the phonon field into a propagating photon that can be propagated throughout, for instance, optical fiber and transported over long distances. Just to give an example how such an experiment could look like, this is an experiment which is a classical simulation of such a protocol. We have here a very strong pump field, which is on, in essence, constantly. We inject a small excitation, and this excitation in this case is a very weak coherent state. When we excite, in essence, with this very weak coherent state on cavity resonance, what we can do is we can probe this interaction both in the weak and a strong coupling regime. If we look at the weak coupling regime, if we inject this excitation and read out our mechanical oscillator amplitude, what we see is that as we inject the weak excitation, the mechanical oscillator amplitude decays, in essence, with simply the cavity decay rate kappa. Okay, this is what you expect. Now, however, if you go into the regime of strong coupling, okay, where the interaction becomes larger than the heavy decay rate, what you see is suddenly the mechanical oscillator, in essence, has this characteristic, in essence, collapse and revival structure. And if you look at the decay rate of the harmonic signal, this suddenly now is twice as long. Okay, why is this? Because as you put the pulse of, or as you have the optical pulse basically transformed or transferred into the mechanical oscillator, and this exchange is going on, the dissipation from the optical field is much quicker than the dissipation gamma m of the mechanical oscillator. So that means now that the energy decay time of the system actually is just kappa over 2. Again, it's the same physics you encounter also, of course, in other systems, but again shows this feature of this strongly coupled optical and mechanical view of freedom. Now, if you were to repeat the same experiment, not with a classical excitation, as we did, even though we used here a very weak one with only 0.19 quanta on average, but if you were to, for instance, replace this by a deterministic single photon source, you would be able to map, for instance, the single photon state of the light field onto the mechanics and have, in essence, an interaction analogous to cavity QED, in essence, so Rabi oscillations between light and the mechanical system. Okay? This is, of course, a very enticing, in essence, experiment, certainly not one that is easy, but it is an experiment that is directly, in essence, a consequence or directly enabled by this quantum coherent coupling regime. Now, so in summary, I've described to you our efforts in developing low dissipation optical mechanical structures, the techniques developed in both reading out a mechanical oscillator, characterizing its coupling strength, and also the ability to place the system in this quantum coherent coupling regime. And in the future, one of the very interesting aspects, of course, will be to explore the regime of coherent interaction with light and mechanics, for instance, to transfer, in essence, the optical field of, say, a single photon onto a mechanical oscillator and back, but also to perform, in a more general setting, quantum measurements on a mechanical oscillator. There's a very rich literature by Raginsky and others of how you can perform quantum non-emission measurements on mechanical systems. And all these ideas have been around for many decades, and now this optimal mechanical system is really an ideal prototype toy system by which you can place these predictions of quantum measurement theory in an experimental setting. And I think this is going to be a very interesting regime, of course, on the fundamental side. On the applied side, of course, there's a lot of work on optical transducers. The idea here is to couple the mechanical oscillator to some other systems. And so we have also made some progress at this at EPFL, where, for instance, we have a small nanomechanical beam coupled to a cavity. And this nanomechanical beam can, in principle, be further functionalized and really serve here as our transducer from, in essence, an external degree of freedom to the mechanics to the optical degree. Finally, I'd like to thank here, also again, one more time, my coworkers. In particular, I'd like to thank Samuel de Leglise, who is now in the group of Antoine Heidmann, also Olivier Atizé, who is in Grenoble, and this is the present team, so Ewald and also Nicolas and Vivicek, who are taking over the experiment in kind of a new direction. Thank you for your attention.